Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Medical Whistleblower Blog Talk Radio Show, coming to you live. I am Dr. Jeanette Parker and the founder of Medical Whistleblower Advocacy Network, and it's truly an honor to be with you today. It's 4 p.m. Central Time on Sunday, September 11th. And as always, Medical Whistleblower Show can be listened to live at blogtalkradio.com/medicalwhistleblower, or you can listen to it live on demand anytime you like at the same internet address. Today, I am joined by Richard Wierowski, former FAA safety inspector and member of the FAA Whistleblowers Alliance, and who worked with the Government Accountability Project. I am sorry to say that Reverend Seiko will not be joining us today, but may, of course, join us at a later date on this Medical Whistleblower Show. Richard, would you like to say a few words about this historic day?
Yes. Thank you, Jeanette, for having me on. It's kind of emotional for me. It's hard to believe 10 years have gone by since 9/11. It seems like it was yesterday. I was having a peaceful breakfast down by the beach just before I was going to go on my job. I was with the FAA Flight Standards Office in Farmingdale. And we just heard something that somebody said, hey, something happened. And this was in the morning, and I would start my shift at approximately 4 p.m. in the afternoon. And what that was is... FAA inspectors are required to go on accident standby duty every 3 months, and my shift was during the week of 9/11, and it was a very uneventful week. Nothing was really going on. I was just doing my normal job, helping pilots and mechanics and going around the aviation industry in my government G-car, as we call them, with my emergency equipment in case anybody needed any help or needed paperwork. And it's hard to believe that it happened. And when you look at it going back 10 years, you just have to open your mouth and just look. You can't talk sometimes. I have to say, interesting things happened that day. When I got home, I found out that the plane had hit the building, and the second plane had not hit the building yet. And again, my job was to basically work on Long Island, New York, covering the airports, which go out to Montauk Point, East Hampton, Brookhaven Airport, Islip Airport, Bayport Airport, Republic Airport. All those airports were under the jurisdiction of my office. And they were very busy airports, and all my aviation life, which is now going on 43 years in the industry, I've never experienced something like this. I don't think anybody has. And going through the day after the attacks, especially the FAA, in their infinite wisdom, decided to close all the FAA offices on Long Island for whatever reason, which was a decision that shocked me at the time. In other words, they have a regional office with hundreds of people there. They have a New York office. It's a field office with probably about 50 people. And my office was the Farmingdale office, and that had about 30 people in it, including me. And they put all those people, they closed down. They put all those people out of work for those 3 or 4 days after 9/11. I don't know why. But I was still on duty. I still had my accident standby job to do, and the next 2 days, which I think I got about 3 hours sleep, I just was busy going to all the airports, working with managers of the airports to close down these airports in case something else happened. I mean, people have to realize we didn't know what was going to come next. Most people think of aviation as large aircraft, the airlines. And my end of it was small aircraft. They call that general aviation, charter companies, flight training, medevac type things. and that's what I was responsible for. So when this happened, there's quite a few airports that have no control towers, and nobody really talks to them. They call them non-towered. And I said to myself, gee, these people don't really know what's going on. Maybe they're not aware that everything has been grounded in the whole country for the first time since World War II. Every aircraft in the air, unless you were military or police, was grounded. And if you went into the air, you had the risk of being shot down by the military or the police. They armed the helicopters.
And there's always a lot of planes in the air at any one time, isn't there? I mean, there would have been planes in the air at the time the order to shut down happened. So many of them were still in flight to their destination.
Well, that was a situation in itself. A gentleman named Ben Salini, who was in Reston, Virginia, he was in the FAA command center, that's air traffic control, his first day on the job, and he was a very interesting fellow. Without any approval from anyone, he took it upon himself to ground every aircraft in the air. It took 2 hours to bring down thousands of aircraft. Every one of those aircraft were brought down safely without any loss of life. And his heroic effort, and that's what I call it, prevented any further damage, because it was later discussed that there were possible other terrorists that were ready to strike. The aircraft weren't in position yet. Other cities, and Mr. Salini's decision to land everybody dwarfed that. And they had one instance where when aircraft landed, and 5 or 6 seedy, strange-looking people scurried off the airplane and were never seen again. The heroism that went on that day of pilots landing plane after plane in airports, any airport they can find, to bring down that many airplanes without any loss of life was ATC. They were very heroic in doing that. And the air traffic control people really performed that day. But the FAA, for some reason, closed down after that. They said, okay, everybody go home, go watch television, don't just go home. And I wasn't notified. I actually went into my office after that, right after the second plane hit. I called my management, and they said, oh, yes, come in. And I went into the office in my government car. I got on the parkway, and I was doing 100 miles an hour and picked up a policeman on my tail. I said, oh, brother, I'm going to get a ticket. It's funny what you think of in days like when days something like that happens. And instead, the officer got in front of me and was an escort all the way to my destination, which was my office, which I found was closing. And then I went to work, and I went to these airports day and night. I was very concerned for my safety, but I said, well, I think I have to do something. I can't go home. I can't sit and watch this. So I went to these different airports, and I did the best I could. And I got a lot of questions from people and managers of the airports and operators at the airports asking me, what should I do? What do we need to do? Can we do anything? And I just said, well, the only thing I can tell you is, shut down, don't operate, don't move an aircraft on the ground, because we don't know if that could be a terrorist now stealing a smaller airplane and heading to do more damage. So that was the day, and it was split decisions. There's no script to follow. There was no guidance, as the FAA likes to call it. And actually, when it was all over, about a week later, I was called in the office and reprimanded for doing it. And which, to my surprise, I didn't put down any additional time on my timesheet, which is what they were more worried about, which shows you some examples of how we got into this situation, in my opinion. So that's 9/11, 9/12, 9/13. I was doing that, and that my shift ended, and I brought the emergency vehicle back to the office, and the office then opened on the following Monday, which was about 9/16. And FAA personnel went back to work. And I feel that they should have been in the field. That decision to close down was very, very strange, in my opinion.
Now, you speak to many pilots, don't you? You are a pilot yourself?
Oh, yeah, I'm a pilot.
You've been a pilot for many, many years.
Yes.
And you are also a person who is a certified airframe and power plant mechanic with inspection authorization. So you know all about how planes are inspected to make sure they're safe. And you've been flying since 1969, haven't you, Richard?
Yes. Yes, I have. And with the FAA,
you've spoken to many pilots and crew who came off planes that were in the air at that time, or even new people who were on the planes that had been hijacked. Because, you know, airline employees often fly to their next tour duty on planes. So they're even members of the airline industry actually as passengers on planes. Isn't that true?
Yes. Actually, a story is an operator of mine called me, and I had my number available to all the operators that I had responsibility for. And he was a charter operator out of White Plains, and his wife worked for United Airlines. She was a flight attendant. And when this happened, when the planes hit the towers and the Pentagon and they went down in Shanksville, the airlines can contact their aircraft in the air, and they called, and the captain called everybody up. They sent the co-pilot out of the cockpit, locked the door. They moved all the serving carts in one of the United flights and brought them up front, and all the flight attendants and the co-pilot got behind the serving carts. After they had everybody strapped in and they were making an emergency descent to the land, and they were going to protect that cockpit. If anybody attempted to head towards the cockpit and would not stop, the co-pilot, the only weapon he had was a crash axe. They had a couple of crash axes to protect themselves from the terrorists. There were about five or six terrorists per airplane. And for an agonizing 12 hours, my operator didn't know if his wife was alive or not. So that's some of the stories that went on in 9/11 to bring these planes down, to bring them and land them in these different airports was a major feat. Some airports had well over capacity, airplanes on jammed into the airport. People opened their houses for the crews so that they could stay there, and it was unbelievable. That's the time our country really came together, and unfortunately, we're back fighting with each other again. And 10 years later, I'm concerned. I always ask people the question, after 10 years now, do you feel safer? You know, when I see people and we talk about it, and of course they say no. Or TSA or Homeland Security has spent probably $1 trillion protecting the country since 9/11. That's an awful lot of money. And I wonder how effective it is. There's things going on that the average person doesn't realize, and I'll touch on some of them. Our aviation industry was very strong before 9/11, and we've lost billions of dollars and thousands of jobs in our aviation industry to overseas facilities. So what we have here at home is we have TSA inspecting you when you get to the airport. You know, everybody's been through it. Take off your shoes. You can't have liquids. They'll check babies. They'll check people in wheelchairs. And all that has to be done. And you say, okay, well, it's for safety. But the actual aircraft that you get on, that you fly on, may have been maintained in a third world country. And that's something to think about. If an aircraft is in a third world country, I always ask people, do you know the difference in the maintenance facilities in a U.S. facility versus a third world facility? And most people don't know. I have to tell them. Probably one of the biggest differences is there's no security in a lot of these third world facilities. El Salvador comes to mind. third world country, a very big maintenance base, and a lot of our aircraft could go there for major maintenance, be sitting completely apart in pieces and not have any security watching it. And I'm very concerned about that. Here at home, we're putting on the show. Everybody's feeling better. And meanwhile, our aircraft are not protected. And with today's technology, Jeanette, I don't have to tell you what could be done to an aircraft and what could be lying ahead with all our aircraft going through this situation. Especially, these facilities do not do background checks, drug testing. They do the job 30 cents on the dollar compared to a U.S. facility. And all this adds up to weakening the industry and making it less safe. Our government spends billions of dollars a year on security when the aircraft go overseas, and they're sitting ducks, in my opinion. So there's some things for people to think about. And I welcome anybody to look into that information. It's available. And if not, they can definitely ask me, and I'll get it to them. And I'd like to mention, before I forget, if you don't mind, on September 19th and 20th, the Whistleblowers Convention will start in Washington, D.C., and it's hosted by the Government Accountability Project. And that's a meeting of all people in government that care about their job and did their job properly and then lost their job because they spoke up or they wouldn't do something illegal. We call it whistleblowers or lamplighters, I like to call them. Actually, I got that from Frank Serpico, if everybody remembers him.
He might even be there.
He'll be there.
Well, Frank might even be there, yeah.
Yeah,
he'll be there last year.
Yeah. They have it at a unique location called the Mott House, which is the only, as far as I can see, freestanding private home right next to the Supreme Court building, right next to Charles Schumer's office, the New York senator, which I invited him to come to that. I don't think he'll come, though. And it's a very good meeting. We're going to have probably a very important speaker from the NSA, that was almost got 35 years in prison for supposedly leaking, which wasn't true. Help me with the name. I just forgot it. He's going to be there to talk about his ordeal. In other words, the government said that you leaked security information when he didn't do it. And he'll be there to basically talk about his situation. And other whistleblowers, including myself, will be there speaking. And our aim is to keep government on their toes, and keep them from making mistakes like 9/11. Because I always ask.
Yeah, the FAA, the Whistleblowers Alliance will be there. They'll be running a panel. I understanding is.
Yes. Yes, Gabe Bruno is the executive director of the FWA, and I'll be on a panel with him and Ed Jaresker, another FAA inspector, and Kim Farrington, another FAA inspector, and we'll be on a panel to discuss the FAA and some of the mistakes they've been making that they're still making. But I like to ask this question, and it's been bothering me for years, and I say, who has ever been held accountable in government for the failure to protect the American people during 9/11? And I can't see one person that was reprimanded, removed, or put in jail for 9/11 when there were obvious failures in government management. And when the people that worked under them protested, they were fired, removed from their job, or put down in the basement collecting light bulbs. And 9/11, probably one of the really sharp people I can think of is Brogdan Devanovich, who was with the FAA Red Team, and he was demoted and stuck in the basement counting light bulbs, as he likes to say, for exposing the failures before and even after 9/11. So this is the kind of things that
You might want to explain to people what a red team is, because I'm not sure that everyone in our audience will know what
sure.
a red team is.
It's actually was a team of inspectors that would go to an airport and basically try to sneak in security, sneak in bombs, simulated, of course, weapons, knives, guns. And ironically, the red team was successful 90% of the time to sneak in whatever they wanted in through the security supposed checks before 9/11.
And this was a way of checking to see if security measures were enough to stop that kind of sabotage.
Yeah, but see, the problem with security back before 9/11, and it wasn't really a security screening, it was more of a customer service. You know, a lot of people, I would say, you know, we look at TSA, they're much more stricter in what they do compared to the baggage screeners before 9/11. Part of the reason was it was run by the airline itself. They went the lowest cost way, in other words, minimum wage screeners, and they really didn't look too hard. Box cutters and little knives and things like that, which the terrorists used, amazingly, to overcome the aircraft, were not even detected. And the flight attendant herself would actually have the key for the cockpit in her apron, and they were aware of that. It took the terrorists 2 years to plan this, and they knew all the little things like, well, the head flight attendant had the key for the cockpit. So all they did was kill her, take the key and open the cockpit door, and of course, overcome the crew and then take over the airliner. It was so simple, and we were ripe to be picked. And I think of this, and sometimes I have to go drink when I think of it. It makes me want to, get out of the world for a while. But the thing here is, I'm sorry, go ahead.
For the families who have lost loved ones, this September 11th, this will be obviously a very sad day of remembrance. And I'd like to take a moment to honor and remember all the nearly 3,000 victims who were killed that day.
It was 3,200, Janet, 3,200. 3,200 counting all the airliners, the Pentagon, Shanksville, and the buildings. It totaled, that's quite a bit of people.
And that included persons from all countries all over the world.
Yeah,
and,
not just Americans.
International passengers on the plane.
Yes.
And so for many,
Muslims.
This marks a day they'll never
Muslims.
Forget. And I remember myself feeling initially a lot of just shock, and it was hard to grasp the finality of the event, even conceive what might lie ahead, and having a hard time letting go of the memories of persons lost. I think prior to these tragic events, we took for granted our safety and security. But I think we also took for granted our freedoms. Because in that particular day, our lives were changed irrevocably. And there were many secondary victims, those who were traumatized by watching or hearing the events. I remember hearing stories of courage and bravery of the firefighters, the police officers, the paramedics, and also those who were evacuating the building. We heard stories of courage and bravery of ordinary people who responded to help people in need trapped within the buildings. And so many responded in extraordinary ways, helped strangers down flights of stairs to safety, rescue workers who searched tirelessly for survivors. And you and I both know many people who were in our national service who jumped into action to try to protect the nation. I know one of the pilots that was on the plane that was scrambled, you know him too, of course, was scrambled to respond to the attack while when the first plane had hit and the other two were still in flight. And he was, how many minutes did they give him? 7 minutes to get into the plane and up into the air, something like that. I can't even imagine getting anything ready in my life in that amount of time. But, you know, they're ready and to scramble. They're sitting there ready, prepared to jump into action. And he was scrambled, and he immediately got into his jet, and he was immediately into the air. And you know a lot about this because you're a pilot. I know that the suddenness of the attacks, we question the capabilities of our government intelligence to detect terrorist attacks, and many were left wondering about the safety procedures of airlines, the effectiveness of our disaster preparedness, especially when we had the major problems with communications right there as people were trying to respond to the towers disaster. And many questioned our general defense systems because there was this mock disaster exercise happening at the time. You and I, we both know that. And that made it difficult for the towers to respond to possible airplanes that had been hijacked.
There's only 300 towers in the United States out of our 12,000 airports. To kind of put that in perspective, Kennedy Airport, those type airports, LAX. So we have about 300 towered, controlled airports that nothing can move without being controlled. It's the non-towered airports that I was worried about. We have four of them here on Long Island, and they're pretty busy, actually five, counting a little tiny one. And anything could happen. I mean, at the time, nobody knew what was going to happen after that. It was kind of like after Pearl Harbor, they thought the Japanese were going to invade Hawaii. Well, of course, they never did, but they could have. That was probably their blunder. But the thing here is, this is the worst attack on our country ever. The Japanese were a military force, and we were a military force, and it was off our shores. And here we have a terrorist organization living in mud huts, basically with no water or electricity, attacking us this way. They had to have some help from somebody, these nations that condone terrorism, and I sure like to make them pay. After all these years of wars and everything, I still don't feel closure myself. So,
well, of course, now, 10 years after the 9/11 attack, there's still many questions about why and how that happened, questions that were not answered by 9/11 Commission or by our government officials.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions.
We have 90 seconds left in our show at this point, so I would like to affirm that we as a nation need to improve our ability to understand these events. We need to not scapegoat innocent Muslims. We need as a nation to take a high moral ground and affirm the values of human rights, while at the same time securing the safety of the American people. And I believe that this is an important thing that we do, continued efforts for public and private efforts in partnership to have a public discourse about policy and reasoned discussion on these issues. And I want to, again, honor those who died today, 10 years ago, and to reach out to all people who were harmed including persons of all faiths, creeds, nationalities, who were at the time of 9/11.
Yes, absolutely.
Traumatized. So this is Medical Whistleblower. We will probably be back to you again on these issues. And I thank you for being with me, Richard.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. We've come up from the ashes. 9/11 is 10 years ago, but they don't call it Ground Zero anymore, Jeanette. It's a rebirth. When you look at what's going on there, you have to feel better. And maybe we've learned our lesson, maybe. That's all I have to say, really. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And I want to, emphasize that the problems of 9/11 were not ones that should be directed towards any particular people, but instead towards our entire nation's security system and the way we address our concerns. And we harmed ourselves by using methods against our presumed enemies that were actually against our ethical and moral conscience.
Well, that's sobering words, Jeanette. Very sobering. We're good people. We'll overcome this, and it'll never happen again. I'm going to do the best I can, just like everybody. We're still together.
So we can see Medical Whistleblower Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. And I thank you for being with me, Richard.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Have a good night now.
Good night.